Hey everybody, this is Bobby Osinski and you're listening to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. This is a show about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is David Campos, who's a jingle producer, and he's done jingles for McDonald's, Coke, Nokia, and Toyota, just to name a few. He's also won a Clio Award for his work as jingle producer, and he's going to talk about the different aspects of producing and writing jingles, which I'm sure you're going to find very interesting. First, we're going to talk about some things in the news this week, and the first thing is Prince. Prince did a new deal with Warner Brothers this week, and why is that a big deal? Well, once upon a time, Prince was signed to Warner Brothers, and Warner's was the label that kind of made him a star. All his biggest hits were done on Warner's, and the only problem was, after a certain time, Prince noticed that he wasn't getting paid what he thought he should, and he rebelled. And what he did was he would appear in public with "slave" painted across his forehead, and he eventually changed his name to that unpronounceable insignia, and became the artist formerly known as Prince. And the reason for that is he didn't want to promote any of his music that was on Warner Brothers. And since he's pretty much been do-it-yourself, he's had some deals here and there with other labels, but for the most part, he's been self-producing his own music. And he's always produced it, but he's been self-distributing it and selling his own music. And you'd think an artist like Prince would actually have it fairly easy. But the thing that happens with an artist after a certain period of time, after a certain level of success, is that the infrastructure required really goes sort of beyond what you can do yourself. So the do-it-yourself ethic is really important, and it's something that today just about every artist needs. But there comes a point in time when, in order to jump levels, you need the infrastructure of a record label. Now, you don't have to necessarily do a record deal with them, a traditional record deal. You can actually hire some of their services that they're good at, their marketing and promotion especially. Distribution is fairly easy to come by. So you can get these parts of infrastructure that are very difficult to put together yourself. It's like reinventing the wheel. Why should you do it? Because the wheel's already invented, so let's just go find a way to use someone else's wheel or to buy our own. So Prince is a perfect example here. He got to a certain point where he really wasn't selling that much. Prince sold about 18.5 million albums since 1991. So that means in 13 years, he hasn't done all that well. And 14 million of those actually came through Warner Brothers. So if you look, he hasn't sold that many albums. Now, this is the United States. Worldwide, he's done better, obviously. But really, for a superstar like Prince, you expect a lot more, especially during the time when albums were really selling in the late 90s and early 2000s. So that being said, Prince went back to Warner Brothers. And obviously, he got probably much better terms on his deal, but he has a 30th anniversary of Purple Rain box set coming out. He has a brand new album and a brand new tour. And the only way for him to make it on a level that he needs to make it is to have that infrastructure. So the reason why I bring that up is the fact that do-it-yourself is great, and it's something that I teach in my coaching courses and my books. And it's something that every artist has to know. But you also have to realize that at some point in time, what's going to happen is if you've reached a level of success and you want to go beyond that, the only way to go is with the record label on some level. It doesn't have to be the way it used to be, you know, signing your life away to a label. And those days are kind of over. If you've reached a certain level of success, you can't necessarily name your terms, but on the other hand, the terms are much more favorable to you if that's the case. So keep that in mind, and go to Forbes and read my article. There's a lot more about it, and you can get a bit more insight on how this all works and how it works for Prince as well. The next thing I want to talk about is commonalities of hit songs. And if you've read my Big Picture Music Production blog, you know that every Friday I do some sort of deconstructed hits. Sometimes I break down a song completely and we look at all the elements. And sometimes it's just I find a video that has the isolated parts, isolated guitar parts or vocals or things like that. And we play them back and listen, kind of analyze how those parts were put together. And it's something that I really enjoy doing, and I do a lot. And one of the things about being a producer, you find yourself doing it whether you want to or not. And I just decided to kind of put those thoughts down on paper. I've also written a series of books on the subject called Deconstructed Hits, which looks at hits from various genres and various eras of the music business, and, you know, kind of breaks them down. So here's some of the things I've found that you might find interesting. Most hits are relatively short. The songs today average about 3 minutes and 47 seconds in length. And that's actually fairly long, believe it or not, as compared to the hits of the 50s and 60s and even the 70s, where they were trying to get more for the 3 minute mark. And now we're up to about 3:47. But still, 3:47, you have to pack a lot in at 3:47. The other thing that's interesting about most modern hits is they have really short intros. The intro averages about 7.5 seconds to a current hit. And in general, you found that in hits of the past and hits in different genres, but sometimes it might go to 10 or 12 seconds. So it's a little shorter these days as well. The other thing you find about most hits, and this is any genre, any era, is the fact that most hits, they limit the number of arrangement elements that happen at the same time. Now, I was taught when I first came to LA that you have only 5 arrangement elements that can happen at any one time. And arrangement element would be like the rhythm section, for instance, that would be the bass and drums and maybe a rhythm guitar, and that's one element. The next would be a pad, for instance, and a pad would be, something playing chords, for instance, like a Hammond or a Rhodes or even strings. That's kind of like a glue that pulls everything together. Another element would be a rhythm element that pushes things along, which again could be a rhythm guitar or percussion many times. And then you have a lead element, which is usually a lead vocal, or if it's an instrumental, it would be the lead instrument. And then finally, you would have something that is doing fills. And fills happen in between the lead element. So there'd be a lead vocal phrase, and then something would fill in between the phrases. And this could be an instrument like a sax or a guitar, or maybe vocals, background vocals, things like that. But usually what happens is there's no more than 5 of these elements going at one point in time. And most likely it's going to be less. Sometimes it's 3, sometimes it's 4. But you're going to find that almost all hits limit the number of arrangement elements that occur at the same time. The other thing that you'll find with most hits is the arrangement of most hits develops over the course of a song. So you listen to the song and it may start out really big, and then the first verse, it drops down. And that could mean a couple things. Either the playing is with less intensity, or it could mean that there's some musical elements that will fall out. So, for instance, that there may be some guitars that aren't playing during a verse. And then during the B section, then they'll come in again. And then all of a sudden, it will get bigger and more intense during the chorus. And then it'll drop down a little bit on the second verse. And it will get a little bigger on the second B section and even bigger on the second chorus. And then you'll find that every song has a peak. And the peak will usually occur at a bridge, and almost all songs have something that kind of acts like a bridge. So you'll find the peak will either be there or on an out chorus, but all songs have a peak. So there's always this tension and release that's happening. There's a lot of intensity, and then there's less intensity. And that's what we like about music. Music is something where, just like all art is tension and release. So for instance, photography is dark against light. in music, we're talking about loud against soft. So there's always that that's happening in a song. The other thing that happens is in modern hits, and I'm talking about hits that are out right now, most songs have an ending and what we'd call a hard ending, where the ending just hits and it's finished. Where in the past, there were eras where there were nothing but fades. All songs had a fade. And for the most part, if you take a listen, songs today have a real hard ending. And I think that's a good thing, because you have to think about how to end a song. It takes some thought, and fading is kind of an easy way out. So I've always liked, you know, hard endings, and I think that's a really good trend. Now, obviously, there are exceptions to all of these rules. So you can't take anything as a hard and fast rule, because, you know, someone will figure out a way to do it differently and it'll be more interesting. So, but just take notice that these are trends that are happening in music today. And the next time you listen to any song, either on the radio or streaming or CD or whatever it might be, just listen for these things that we just talked about. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. That's questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is David Campos, and David is a really interesting cat. He's not only a great jingle producer who's done jingles for all the major brands, but he's also a teacher as well. He has some great courses that he's done, some of the best I've seen. And you know, as someone who makes these courses myself, I got to say, I you know, when there's something really good, I know how hard it is to make these things. And he has something called Advanced Music Production, which he's going to talk about in a little bit. And he also has, as a subset of that, a programming course and a composition course. And you're going to find that he has an interesting take on jingle production. So here's David. My guest today is David Campos, all the way from South Africa. He's a jingle producer and a really great one as well. And you have some great courses too that I want to get to and talk about later. But let's talk about how you get into the music business, because you have a great story and how that happened.
Well, hi, Bobby. Thanks for the intro. And it's a pleasure to be on this podcast. And I got started in the music business very, very young. You know, I was born into a musical family. My father was a music producer and started playing piano from like 4 or 5 years old. And I just had this passion for music. And I'm just trying to think, which story exactly are you referring to? Are you talking about the email that I sent you?
Well, just the fact that you were around your father, and your father was a famous producer in his own right, and yeah, and you basically got a lot of what he was doing because you're always around him, right?
That's right, yeah. I always loved computers, and I always loved playing piano, and I loved composition. So when I started hanging around my dad in the studio and seeing all the gadgetry and all the technology, it just excited me to no end. So I wanted to get in there and get stuck into the computers and stuff like that. And so my dad was my greatest inspiration and what got me into the music business. And he was actually a little bit of, you know, sometimes I relate to Michael Jackson, because, you know, Michael Jackson's dad used to, you know, he'd get in trouble if he didn't practice dancing and singing. And my dad used to ask me, what's Del Sancoda? You know, who wrote this song and who wrote that song? And, you know, he used to test me all the time. Who's the bass player for Kunonia? You know, it's Abraham Laboriel, you know, a little 9-year-old. So, but I loved it. You know, for me, I never felt like I was being forced. I just loved music, and I loved technology, and music production was just a perfect fit for me.
So he was very hands-on teaching you then?
Yeah, from a very young age, 5, 6 years old, teaching me chord structures and melodies and harmonies and production. And my dad was a guitarist. So I guess the way I rebelled was I didn't like the guitar. I learned how to play piano.
Some rebellion. Wow.
Yeah.
You tell a really good story about the first gig that you got, the first paying gig.
Yeah.
Can you tell that, please?
You know, I was 12 or 13 years old, and I was in my dad's studio and just hanging around, and this client came in desperate for my dad to compose. He needed like 20 tracks by the next day, and that all had to be like kind of mood romantic piano songs. And the guy had a very small budget. I think it was like $500 or something like that. And my dad just couldn't do the job. It was just too much, too low budget. And my dad was so busy. And I kind of jumped in there. I don't know what came over me. I was only like 12 years old. And I said, I'll do it. And my dad like looked at me, and the client looked at me, and they thought, what's this 12-year-old doing? And my dad said, are you serious? You think you can do this? And I said, yeah, give me a try. And my dad convinced the client, and I worked through the night. And by the next morning, the client came in 9 o'clock in the morning, and I played him the 20 tracks that I'd composed for him, 20 romantic piano tracks. And he gave me the $500, and $500 for a 12-year-old. This is like 20 years ago, so it was a lot of money to me. And when I saw that money, I knew this is it. This is going to be my business. This is what I'm going to do.
So from there then, did you do paying gigs? Is that like the beginning, or is there a period before you started to do more, or how did that work?
No, I mean, that was just a once-off example. You know, I used to sing sometimes. I sang in choirs, and I studied drama, and I also worked as an apprentice for my dad from the age of 16 to 21. And only then at 21, I decided to leave and start my own music production company and go it alone. I actually had a split from my father. I think, you know, it's a typical, you know, it's the old patriarch and the young patriarch. Eventually, you don't see eye to eye. And I felt like we needed to progress the business further and further and be more progressive with our music production. And my dad was a little bit falling behind in the, you know, old school in his, the way he used to do things. And I felt like it was time for me to do my own thing. So actually how I got started, what really gave me the confidence was I was sent off to a brief. My dad was so busy, he didn't have time. And I arrived there at this ad agency, and they said to me, okay, this is the brief. This is what you must do. And then they started calling me Mark all the time. Yeah, Mark, and this Mark and Mark. And that was my dad's name. And then I realized for the first time, these guys had never met my father. They dealt with me so much that they thought I was Mark. They were told, you're working with Mark. Mark is the best. And here was this guy. I was only like 21. And that's when I realized I could pull this off. You know, if these guys think that I'm my dad, and I finished the job from start to finish, then I thought, I can do this.
Wow. Wow. That's very cool.
Yeah.
Let's talk about jingle production for a second, because I know a lot of my listeners don't know that much about it. What's the difference between jingle production and straight up record music production?
It's a huge difference. And you'll find that jingle writing skills is a whole nother bag of skills that you need. I always dreamed of producing albums, but I was in the jingle world producing jingles. And you know, in jingles, what happens is you'll pick up a job and somebody needs you to do country music or, you know, bluegrass or something. And you know nothing about the style, so you run off and you buy 10 CDs in that style. You just analyze the chords, analyze the instruments, analyze the tempo, analyze the time signature and things like that. And then you hustle, you know, you find a violin player and you find a, you know, a banjo player or whatever it is, and you make it happen. And I found like after doing that for quite a few years, 10 years or so, I really became a really good producer because I started to see patterns. You know, I noticed that similar patterns in hip hop music that I found in house music, that I found in, you know, EDM and pop. And I started to see the universalness of music. And so I kind of became like an expert in analyzing styles and seeing, you know, what are people doing in different styles. So also it made me, I got a lot of confidence because I almost felt like there's nothing that I can't do because I'd managed to overcome so many challenges in the past. You know, I firmly believe in the concept of fake it until you make it. You know, I've never said no to a job ever. I just went for it and tried my best, and always seemed to somehow in the end, in the midnight, hour, you know, somehow figured it out. And I think jingle writers are very good in meeting deadlines and coming up with new styles and, you know, doing things I've never done before. Whereas I find album producers tend to be pigeonholed, you know, not always, but they tend to, you know, like a David Guetta will almost always produce EDM, you know what I mean? You won't find David Guetta doing classical music. Whereas I'm the type of producer that, and I've also learned an appreciation for all the styles of music because of that. So my listening music is everything from, you know, easy listening jazz all the way to hardcore underground club music, you know, and I appreciate all those styles of music. And it's helped me to become a much better producer.
How long does it take you typically when you get an order to write something? What's the time frame that you usually have?
That's another thing. Deadline is a big thing in the ad industry. We have a saying, hurry up and wait. You know, they give you the job, they give you the deadline. And often I've had situations where I've saved clients, you know, they've been let down by another producer or they just didn't plan properly and their timings ran out, and I've managed to pull something out of the hat in a few hours. And working fast is another major benefit to being a jingle writer. You can't be a slow, kind of ponderous, creative type of person. You won't make it in the jingle business.
So how long do you usually have? What's the normal time frame then? Is it like a day or tomorrow?
Anything from a day up to the maximum 2 months would be the time frame. Most of the time it's 2 days, 3 days in my experience. And you never know. Another difficult thing that's very different about jingle writing is there's a lot of politics involved because you're dealing with corporates and there's like hierarchy, you've got to know whose rank is higher than another. Like a client service is a higher rank than a creative in the ad agency. And the actual client, if it's Coca-Cola, if Coca-Cola corporate walk in the door, you kiss their asses. Nobody's more important than them, you know. And you've got to sniff out now who's the actual boss. So there's stuff like that. Now, where compared to the music business, when I used to, you know, when I produce albums, I found that the artist was the boss. The artist is the most powerful person because if that artist sells records, I mean, they could be drunk and stoned and they could swear at every person in the room and everyone just keeps quiet because they sell records and that's all that matters. So the dynamics are totally different as far as – so writing jingles is also about political and social skills. You need to have – you got to have those things as well to succeed. You got to be a lot more professional and be able to play that game.
How many versions do you do or are you asked to do? Are you asked to do – of different sounding versions or versions that are more orchestrated than others or shorter ones, longer ones? How does that work?
In my experience, I don't think everyone's the same. I've developed like a philosophy of how I produce jingles. One of the things my starting point is always a strong reference, because what I've noticed is language can be very confusing when it comes to describing music. You know, one person will say laid back and in their head they're thinking of Stairway to Heaven, and another person says laid back and they're thinking of like smooth, you know, R&B or something. So the word laid back, for example, means absolutely nothing when you're trying to describe music. And this, so I've literally had a client say, I want the song to sound more orange. I mean, I don't know what the hell that means, you know, orange. So for me, I pressure and push clients to give me clear, concise references. I want reference. I want to hear, what do you mean when you say laid back? Give me an example. And then I found that almost tying down that brief to as specific as possible is the first step in succeeding in winning the, you know, getting a product that they want. Another thing we find a lot in the jingle business, they'll edit to like a commercial track or something, and they get something called demo artists. And that's where they become attached to an existing song, but they can't afford to buy the rights or something like that. Or it's not perfectly tailored to the video, so they need someone to compose. And then you've got to realize that. You've got to go, hold on, this picture's working to this track, and there's a reason why they've chosen this track. And then you've got to figure out what that reason is. Is it the beat? Is it the groove? Is it the emotion? Is it the timing? Is it the energy? Is it the style? And then you've got to stay within those boundaries. So it's a very trying to read the brief is the first step in succeeding. But very, very seldom do I these days write multiple versions, because if you get the idea right from the start, most of the time I get it right first time. So
you said that you have to be very quick on what you're doing. In other words, you can't spend a lot of time perfecting your idea.
Yeah.
I guess that means that you're working on instinct most of the time, if that's the case. Your first idea is always the best.
Very true.
Yeah.
Very true.
And you found that to be the case then, usually? Or do you ever have to go back and second guess yourself?
You know, you can actually fall short when you start doing that, because, you know, when you're producing an album, you can say, well, let's set up the bass amp and let's move the mic around and then let's do that for 5 hours and go and have lunch and then come back. And, you know, and guys do that in album production, in jingle, right? You don't have time. You don't even have time to find a bass player. You've got to fake the bass with a virtual bass. So it's like we're starting, where's the drums? Where's the bass? What are we doing? What's the chord structure? You've got to kind of have a pace that you're working at. And it sounds like you might be cutting corners and you might be, you know, slopping music together. And sometimes I feel like, oh my word, I'm really just throwing stuff together. And yet so often it just kind of comes together. And sometimes when you get into that flow, it's like the subconscious takes over. It's like you get into that zone. I think they call it the zone, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like you say, instinct. It's like everything just starts to work together and you quickly adjust the bass back to the chords and you quickly make adjustments and things just kind of, but that instinct gets also honed the more you do that. So I found that sometimes when I went into album production, I found that I had to also take off that jingle writing hat and kind of stop myself and go, hold on, just slow down, think about this idea a bit more. And
what I've found is I've worked with artists in the past that would be just the opposite of that. They would have so many ideas and they'd want to try them all. And we'd always come back to the very first one, you know, and it would be the whole song would be finished and they'd come in and they'd say, I really feel that we should try a reggae version. And then we go through the whole thing and do a reggae version. And then we do something that would be smooth jazz and you know, 5 different versions and come back to the first one. So that would make me crazy, I got to say.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show you, your first instinct is usually the best on those things.
And, yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. I agree with that. Look, in jingle writing, though, the problem is you're not creating music for the sake of like art. And a lot of guys confuse this. My dad used to do this. He would write a jingle and he'd become passionate about it. You know, he'd put his heart into it. And then a client would come and say, like, he'd have this beautiful triangle arrangement going in the background there. And the client would go, what's that funny sound in the back there? Can you take that out? You know, the thing that he spent 3 hours on. And my dad would get so like emotional about it. And like, maybe I was just too pragmatic. I was like, who cares? It's not my song. The client pays me money. It's his song. You know, there's a time that you really do good work and then you want to put your name on it. But then there's other times that you're doing the best work you can within those boundaries of the style you're writing, the time you have, the budget you have, and then the clients and how they're messing up the track. So it is part of the process. You're almost trying to limit the damage clients are creating to the track. And, you know, you have a guy who can play 3 chords on a guitar who's a client service or something now telling you, can you change this chord to that chord? And what do you do? I mean, it's now the politics comes in. So you find a way to make it work that it still sounds good.
You mentioned before about how quickly you have to get things together. And if you can't find a player, you have to fake it. And I'm sure if that must be the case, if you have, you know, 12 hours to get something together, finding players must be crazy. So and you're a great programmer. I've heard your stuff and you teach people how to do that. And you're magnificent at what you do. But I'm curious, did that come before? Were you always a programmer, or did you become a programmer kind of defensively because it's faster than finding players?
Well, it's two reasons. Not only finding players, it's also about money, to be honest with you. You know, sometimes you've got a limited budget and you're thinking, you know, every musician I get in here is another, you know, couple hundred dollars I'm not going to make. So if I can program as much as possible, get just guitar and vocals in, you know, then I make more profit. So it's also about that. But I must be honest, I think it's a combination of the two, because I would say that I kind of started with the Notator SL on Atari 1040ST. And if you remember back in the day, and I was fascinated with MIDI. I was fascinated with programming. So I started with synthesizers and programming with MIDI. And so my first love was really the technology. And then later on, as I got older, I started needing to record guitars and vocals and things like that. So I had to get the skills. And of course, I was lucky to be in the environment where I was surrounded by older sound engineers and, you know, great producers. And of course, my dad was an awesome mentor to me. So that's forced me to up my game as far as being a sound engineer and a traditional music producer is concerned. But I must say, if I can program something in 10 minutes on my computer, why would I phone up someone and wait 24 hours for them to arrive? If they come in 24 hours and then, you know, are they going to give me what I want? And, you know, I'm a little bit impatient, to be honest.
What are you using now in terms of your main platform for
programming? I use Logic Pro X, which I think is awesome. Especially the latest version is just unbelievable. And but I'm not the type of guy that, you know, gets into these arguments about which DAW is better, Pro Tools or Cubase or Ableton or whatever. You know, I've got a lot of friends who work in all of these platforms, and at the end of the day, good music comes from good composers and good programmers. I mean, I also use other DAWs sometimes, and I get great results in any DAW. So I'm just used to Logic. Logic is comes from Notator. Notator became Logic over 20 years, so I've just stayed on the same platform, and I think work with what you're comfortable with.
Well, you said that you can work on multiple DAWs. What would cause you to do that? Is there a reason why you'd say, well, I'm going to work on this today rather than Logic, which is usually your usual preference?
No, not for me. For me, I would always work on Logic Pro X, but if I'm working on someone else's project, or I'm in a foreign studio involved in a project that it's not in my own studio and my own system, then, or if somebody sent me something that's mixed in Pro Tools or something, and I have to, it's going to be easier just to load in Pro Tools and make small changes or something, then I'll do that. And also because I teach, so it helps me to know all the different DAWs so that I can teach in multiple formats.
Being in South Africa, has that limited you as a producer?
I think in the traditional sense, yes, especially in the past. South Africa geographically is possibly the furthest you could be from everywhere. I mean, we're far away from Europe, far away from the States, far away from Asia. We're right, and then we've got this huge landmass of nothing happening between us and Europe. So geographically, but you know, we're living in a new world, a global village, and I really believe the internet has brought the democratization of art. You know, no longer do you have to live in LA and happen to be buddies with, you know, some executive in a record company to get an opportunity, or client person in an ad agency or something. And I've proven that. I've succeeded in producing jingles that have gone to every country in the world. I've won New York Clio. I've had nominations for BBC Music World Awards. And I've achieved all that from South Africa. And in fact, right now, I not only live in the CBD of the main city in South Africa, I've moved to a small town. There's 50,000 people here. I live by the beach. And I'm carrying on producing music for jingles for all over the world on the beach in a small town. So I think the internet has changed how we market ourselves, how we network, and how we get access to opportunities.
So you've done some global jingles then, you're saying. When you get a brief, well, first of all, why don't you tell our listeners exactly what a brief is?
A brief is when you get a phone call and an ad agency or a film production company will phone you up and say, we're interested in you composing music for this project, either a film or a show, TV show, or an advert or something like that. And then you go to a meeting, and it could be a conference call. Most of the time, especially in the old days, they wanted to see you face to face. Then you'd go to that meeting, and then they would give you a brief. And the brief would be, this is what the project's about. This is the budget. This is the product. This is the kind of music we're thinking. You know, is it TV? Is it radio? Is it 30 seconds? Is it 1 minute? Is it... and then that's where you get the feel of the whole project, and you go away from that knowing now where you go from there.
Are the briefs that you get just for South Africa, or are they for, would they be for other countries or global, or is a variety? How does that work?
Okay, well, I work extensively with local South African ad agencies. So obviously, because I am local and I'm well known in this country, I do get a lot of work. But sometimes what happens with advertising, there's many, many ways that your work can land up overseas. Sometimes what happens is you produce an ad in a country and then say Malaysia sees that ad and they go, you know, we love that ad. And let's say the product is Sprite. So we do a Sprite ad for South Africa. Malaysia say, oh, we want to use that exact ad. We're just going to change the voiceover, make it into our language. Now, they own the video rights. They own the recording rights because they paid for it, but they don't own the composition rights. They don't own the publishing. Now, they have to come back to me. They say, can we have your permission? Can we have a license for Malaysia? And often what happens is if the ad is really good, it will spread to more and more countries. And that's one way that it can happen. So another way that happens is sometimes South Africa is also quite a big venue for shooting international commercials. They shoot commercials in Cape Town, and we have kind of like snow-peaked mountains and tropical forests, and we've got deserts. So you can shoot, in fact, a lot of Hollywood movies, the Avengers have been shot in South Africa right now. So sometimes what happens is because I'm linked up with the film production companies, if they're shooting like that's how I got Nokia. I did Nokia for the whole of Australasia because they were shooting it here in the Drakensberg Mountains, which is Snow Peak Mountains. And I was close by. They met me. I did actually what was supposed to be a demo track. And they liked the track so much that they decided to put that as the track on the final ad. And that ad went out to something like 3 billion people. So they had to pay me a lot of money for the license. So that's another way that I got international commercial. You know, there's all kinds of ways. I've had phone calls and emails because my showreel is online, and because I've also done some work overseas. I have some connections with overseas. You know, some guys that I've known, film directors and film producers that have moved around different countries. They still phone me up and say, "I'm sending you the picture on the email. This is the budget. You know, this is I need the thing by tomorrow 12. Can you do it?" And I say, "Yes, I do the track." I email it back to them like within 12 hours, and I send them a bill and I get my money, you know, with you know, when the time is right. And so like I've got a film friend who's a film director in Europe and lives in Poland. I mean, he gives me work all the time. He only works with me. Then I've got another film director friend that also, I think he's in Australia now. So he gives me work. So I've got relationships with film directors that I've built over the years that are also in different countries. So the trick to make getting a lot of work as a junior writer is to have lots and lots of relationships in different ways, film production companies, ad agencies, sometimes the marketing departments of the actual companies that you'd like to work with.
You know, it's funny. I just posted, I think on my blog today, or it might be tomorrow, I'm not sure which one, on the music industry blog, the theory of 250. You ever hear of that?
No.
This actually goes back to the 60s, where they did a number of studies and found out that the average person has 250 friends. That being said, the most successful salespeople and businesses would have 250 clients, would have 250 vendors, would have 250 is kind of like the magic number. So and it didn't mean that you'd get all your work from those 250, but that was like a magic number if you had 250 people, 250 you know, clients that you could call on, then you know you'd be successful. Yeah. But you know,
it's a very interesting theory.
Yeah,
I would say. I would say on my side, one thing I believe in is being very inclusive in your relationships and never cutting people out and always building relationships. It's very important. I've also had the fortune of betting on young talent. Like I've met like film directors, for example, that had no money, no budget to do short films and stuff, and I've helped them out with music. And I mean, the one guy, I helped him out with something like 8 projects and he had no money 8 times. And the next thing you know, he became flavor of the month. And this guy also went and shot some stuff for MTV Europe. And guess who he got to write the music? And I've had music in MTV Europe. So, you know, on a documentary. So sometimes it's I just believe, say yes more often than you say no. You know, you remember that movie, The Yes Man? Mm. You know, he had to just say yes, and I say yes quite a lot. So I find that my circle of friends is huge, and my associates and connections are huge, and I believe that it can only be beneficial to open up your relationships to more and more people, as many as possible.
Have the budgets gone down for you?
In advertising?
Yeah. I mean, it has in the rest of music, where the budgets have gone. Well, I should say recently they've gone up a little bit, but it's nothing as compared to the way it used to be 10 years ago. Is that the same in advertising?
I wouldn't say that. I'd say it's going up just with inflation, and depending how good you are and what you're known for, and it depends on the situation. You know, you must remember, when you're writing a jingle, let's say it's for TV, they have to buy airtime, right, from some TV station. They also shooting a movie. So the movie's going to cost a lot of money. So the music is just this tiny, tiny slither of the budget. So it's not an area where they try and save money, you know. And the quicker you realize this, the quicker you realize how much money can be made. Because one of the things I almost always do is I try and smell the budget. I try and see where they're shooting this, how much money they're spending on the video, where they're going to be airing it. And then I get an idea of how small a percentage is the music budget. And I've managed to make I've had times I've made maybe $15,000 to $20,000 in a day easily. Mm-hmm. But those are like projects that are like $1 million and up, that I know their budgets are over $1 million. So what's $15,000? I've even made more than that in a day. So I don't think that I wouldn't say jingle writing budgets are going down. Oh. It depends on the country as well. I mean, I've heard that my one friend lives in Malaysia, and he's a jingle writer, and he was telling me that what's happened there is there's so many guys with Logic or GarageBand or something on their laptops, and they're all trying to compete with each other for jingles. And he says that's killed the market there, that the prices are going down, 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 and they're kind of undercutting each other. But that hasn't happened here in South Africa, and it hasn't happened on the higher level, the higher echelons that, you know, of advertising that I have seen. I still see huge budgets.
Switching gears for a second.
Yeah.
I know that you, you're a great programmer, and you're also a student of music. And you've put that all together into a course that you're teaching people, and it's very comprehensive, called AMP. And can you describe what that is?
Well, AMP is an acronym for Advanced Music Production. My site is advancedmusicproduction.com. And that's my new baby. It's my new passion, is teaching. You know, I could never actually see myself teaching before, but the more and more I started going online and starting to get guys following me and, you know, commenting on my work, I started to share a few tips and tricks. Guys started to ask me to teach the information. And I know that in my experience, it was very difficult to come by some of the tips and tricks that are in the industry that, you know, a lot of older guys or guys being around know. So I just felt there was a need for it. So I started to teach music production, and that's where I came up with this idea for the AMP course. So what I did was I created a fully comprehensive course, starting from building your own studio, composition, gear, programming, mixing, mastering, all the way through to music business. So, you know, also that's another thing I noticed was a lot of the guys teaching online were teaching in certain areas. You know, some guys are focused on sound engineering. So all they talk about is mic placement and compression and EQ, you know, and then you get other guys, all they talk about is programming, you know, how to make hip hop beats. So I'm being fortunate that I've been in the music business. I've been in music publishing. I've been in jingle writing. I've been in owning a record company. I've built my own studios, and I've been on both sides of the contract, as an artist, as a producer, and then as a record label owner. So I know how the contracts work. So I figured it would be – I really think that it's needed out there, a comprehensive course from start to end. And that's the big course I called AMP, the mothership. And then after that, I decided to start to split some of those modules away and sell the the separate modules separately. So that's also been going very, very well.
I've seen the amp course, and I must say it's magnificent. I don't say this often because a lot of them are good, but yours is great because it does encompass just about everything, and you have an expertise that's different from most people that are trying to do this because it's so wide. Your musical experience, because of the jingles that you're doing and you know, the different genres that you have to do and everything. It's so wide. I was really impressed with the programming course and also the composition course as well. I was really impressed with both of those because, again, you kind of look at it analytically and you don't see that happen in other courses. So,
thank you.
I highly encourage everyone to check those out. Check out where could someone see, go check everything out? You have some videos that are free, right, from the course?
Yes. If you go to advancedmusicproduction.com, you can see all the different courses that I teach. And what I do is I've also got, if you subscribe to any of the crash courses, I've created crash courses basically for each module where I kind of give you a crash course in programming or composition and gives you a good taste of how I teach and the type of information that I'm teaching. So you can get that for free. There's about 4 or 5 lessons per crash course, and you can sign up for any one of those and they're totally free.
And that's what advancedmusicproduction.com, right?
advancedmusicproduction.com. Yeah.
And do you have a site as well where people can, where's your reel at?
Oh, it's at davidcampos.info. Now that's davidcampos.info, info.
So for those of you who want to check out what David does, you can check out his website, and I highly recommend you check out his crash courses and his amp course, which are just wonderful. Thank you so much, David, for being here today. This was great. It was very informative, and as always, I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you very much, Bobby. I'm honored to be on here today, and I'm honored that you said such nice things about my course, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
If you want to find out more about David Campos, go to davidcampos.info. That's davidcampos.info. Also, we got to talking, and David will give listeners of this podcast a discount on his advanced music production course, on his amp course, or on the programming course, or as a composition course, or any of those. If you click on the link that's attached to the podcast here, that you'll find underneath in the description, you'll find that you can get a 50% discount on any of those. And believe me, it's well worth it. So go check those out. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. You can listen to other episodes of Bobby O's Inner Circle by going to bobbyosinski.com and selecting the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com. At bobbyosinski.com, there are links to my blogs and coaching programs, as well as a sign-up sheet for my newsletter, which I think you'll find interesting. So anyway, this is Bobby Osinski, and I will see you next time.